It's the year 1092 of the Christian calendar, the Islamic year 484. Two men stand side by side in Persia's snow-peaked Alborz Mountains. They look up at a looming fortified outcrop, Alamut, the eagle's nest. A third man stands there, his white tunic and red sash just visible at the edge of the precipice. One of the figures below nods, and the man in white jumps to his death. This was a demonstration of power. One of the two men who'd witnessed the scene was an emissary of the Sultan Malik Shah, ruler of the mighty Seljuk Empire. The other was Hasan I Sabah, Grand Master of a religious order that recently had taken control of Alamut. The man who jumped was a follower of Hasan I Sabah. His death was an act of devotion, vivid proof of Sabah's hold over his followers. Hasan I Sabah claimed to have another 70,000 faithful who would die and kill for him. Of course, the same stunt is also attributed to another assassin leader in another place a century later. So much for historical certainty. Sultan Malik Shah was then the most powerful ruler in the Muslim world, or so he thought. He controlled an empire stretching from Anatolia to Central Asia. But Hasan I Sabah ruled an invisible empire of faith and discipline. He was absolute master of a secret society whose covert influence spread throughout Malik Shah's lands and beyond. Sabah called his acolytes Asasiyun, the faithful. That later became confused with Hashishin, or hashish eaters. Today, assassin is our generic term for professional killer, especially one who commits political murders. The assassins have become stock characters in legend, conspiracy theories, and pop culture. They even have their own computer game franchise. Sabah may have exaggerated his numbers, but he didn't exaggerate his control or the threat it posed to the Sultan. Malik Shah's vizier, or chief minister, Nizam ul-Mulk, was struck down that same year by an assassin's dagger. Not long after, the Sultan himself was poisoned, likely by another of Sabah's minions. The Seljuk Empire splintered, and the Middle East fell into chaos. This was the beginning of 200 years of terrorism and murder. The victims would include many more viziers, emirs, and even a crusader king. But the true number of the assassins' victims, their beliefs, and even their origins are hazy. Secrecy, lies, and time have distorted everything. Like so many secret societies, the assassins left almost no written records. And we see them almost entirely through the eyes of their enemies. A dim reflection in the dark mirror of history. Where did they come from? What did they aim to achieve? Where did they go? The assassin's roots reach back at least as far as the beginning of Islam in the 7th century. Muhammad's religion split into two irreconcilable sects almost as soon as it was born, the Sunni and the Shia. This schism still exists today and fuels bloodshed throughout the Muslim world. The dispute was more political than theological. It revolved around who would reign as the Khalif of Islam, the successor to the Prophet Muhammad. Many believed that Muhammad wanted his cousin and son-in-law, Ali, to succeed him. But that didn't happen. Others in Muhammad's entourage opposed Ali's bid. The reason stemmed mostly from jealousy, but some worried that anointing Ali would create a dynasty and a royal bloodline. And that's exactly what Ali's partisans had in mind. They believed that a holy spark flowed from the Prophet to his daughter Fatima and to his cousin Ali and all their descendants. Ali's supporters came to be called the Shia, the party or sect, the sect of Ali. They were also called Fatimids. The inheritors of the holy bloodline were dubbed Imams. If this bloodline business sounds familiar, it's because it echoes the Jesus-Mary-Magdalene bloodline story popularized by Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code. Ollie would have to wait a quarter century and watch three men elevated above him until he filled the shoes of Khalif. But a secret factional war was already underway. Two of his three predecessors were assassinated. And barely 5 years after becoming Khalif, Ali also fell to an assassin. So too did his sons Hassan and Hussein, and almost every Shia imam for the next 250 years. The assassins didn't create a culture of political violence. They were created by it. The Shia, much like later Christian Protestants, split into subsects that further divided into sub-subsects. At issue was which way the holy bloodline flowed, and who was the rightful imam. Some insisted the earthly imams ended with the seventh, Ismail, while others believed it continued to the 12th. Thus, we get seveners and twelvers. The twelvers were the bigger faction. So the Ismaili seveners were a minority of a minority. The Ismailis then spun off another faction, the Nizaris. Hassan Isabah's Assassayoun came from the Nizaris, a schism of a schism of a schism. Regardless of sect, the Shia were almost everywhere a minority, and usually a persecuted minority. Many Shia went underground. They became a secret society. Some adopted taqiyya, or dissimulation. That meant you could conceal, or even lie about, your true allegiance as a means of self-preservation. Secret passphrases and hand signs completed the picture. The late Afghan scholar Idris Shah, an expert on Islamic mysticism, provocatively argued the assassins were based on an earlier association that had appeared in 10th century Cairo. I'll come back to that later. The Shia, while a minority, did enjoy occasional triumphs. Around the year 900, they seized control of Egypt and instituted the so-called Fatimid Caliphate. Its mission was to wage war, both physical and psychological, against the rival Sunni Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad. The shock troops of the Fatimids were specially trained missionaries, or da'is. You could call them secret agents. The da'is penetrated enemy territory, bringing information and encouragement to scattered Shia communities and recruiting new faithful. They functioned much like communist operatives did in the 20th century. Their ultimate aim was to create a Shia shadow state, which would undermine and finally replace the hated Sunni Abbasids. In 1005, the Fatimid Caliph al-Hakim, sometimes called Hakim the Mad, opened the House of Wisdom, or Dar al-Hikmah, in Cairo. Outwardly, a public library and university, it was also the training school of a secret organization dubbed the Society of Wisdom, the Majlis al-Hikmah. According to Shah, it was the training ground for fanatics who were conditioned by the most cunning methods to believe in a special divine mission. Unusual in the Islamic world, it enrolled both men and women. Typical of a secret society, initiates were told they would receive hidden power and timeless wisdom. One graduate of this secret school was the future master of the assassins, Hassan Isabah. Sabah grew up in Ra'i, in the north of present-day Iran, in a Shia family that concealed its faith. As a schoolboy, his closest friends were said to be the future poet Omar Khayyam and the future Seljuk vizier Nizam ul-Mulk, the same Nizam Sabah later had killed. At the root of their quarrel, supposedly, was a schoolboy pact. Whichever of the three boys, Hassani Sabah, Omar Khayyam, and Nizam ul-Mulk, succeeded first was to help the other two climb the ladder. Nizam subsequently gave a helping hand to Khayyam, but not to Sabah. So how much of what Sabah later did was motivated not by religious devotion, but by personal revenge? Sabah, in his Cairo training, had to pass 9 degrees of initiation. The secrets of this initiation were intended only for the chosen, So the versions that have come down to us are undoubtedly incomplete and corrupted. Much of what we know, or think we know, about the assassins comes from one 15th century Egyptian historian, Al-Makrisi. Though a Sunni, Makrisi seems to have been genuinely curious about Sabah and his followers. In any case, Makrisi describes a very sophisticated system of indoctrination and psychological control. In the first degree, the teacher sowed doubt in the mind of the pupil. He undermined faith in everything, even in the Prophet and the Holy Quran. At the same time, the teacher dropped tantalizing hints about a hidden inner powerful truth. But the student wasn't going to get that yet. The only way out of this doubt and confusion was through the student's absolute faith and blind obedience to his teacher. In this, you might recognize what today we'd call cult programming. In the second through sixth degrees, the novice was schooled in the mystery of numbers, especially the numbers 7 and 12, and the mystical nature of the seven lawgivers sent by God: Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and Ismail. The initiate also learned that along with these prophets were seven helpers, or silent prophets. There's the odor of the ancient Pythagorean mystery cult in this number business. The classical teachings continued in the sixth degree, where the aspirant was taught the philosophies of Aristotle and Plato. This was part of his training in analytical and destructive argument. It used reason to undermine or support any proposition. What the Jesuits would later call casuistry, clever but unsound reasoning, that is, situational ethics. The aspirant learned that Islam was just a dim allegory of the truth, its rites and rules empty nonsense. The sixth degree also introduced a mysterious being, the Lord of Time. This also drew from pre-Islamic Persian mythology. Behind the name lay the ancient deity Zerwan, or Boundless Time, a god known to the Greeks as Kronos and to the Romans as Saturnus. In the seventh degree, the novice got his first taste of the real truth. He was introduced to pantheism, the doctrine that all humanity and all creation are one. Likewise, the forces of creation and destruction were one. Thus, good and evil were mere illusions. There are many hints of Gnosticism, a doctrine holding that salvation comes through special knowledge, not faith. The eighth degree continued the deconstruction, reconstruction of the initiate's mind by revealing that the true God was a nameless being, a deity of whom nothing can be predicted and no worship rendered. All this set up the aspirant for the ultimate reveal. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. There was no God, no heaven or hell, no ultimate truth. All that mattered was action, and the only person who could give a valid reason for carrying out an action was the great teacher, the head of the sect. What it arguably boiled down to was antinomianism. Simply put, antinomianism rejects any absolute rules, moral or otherwise. It's a form of nihilism, philosophical anarchism, which isn't to say the assassins believed in nothing. They believed they were right. They believed in the principle that to the pure, all things are pure. Sabah became a da'i, or missionary, and returned to his Persian homeland to carry out his secret mission. His ability to manipulate the minds of others is shown in a story about a sea voyage. His vessel was caught in a storm. The other passengers began to pray for deliverance. When they begged Sabah to pray with them, he refused, claiming that he, through his magical powers, had caused the storm, and only by praying to him could they make it stop. Doubtless, Sabah calculated the storm would pass and the ship wouldn't sink. The desperate passengers offered him their prayers, and sure enough, the storm abated. He landed with a boatload of new believers. Somewhere along the way, maybe as part of his training, Sabah encountered a book called The Art of Imposture. It was a primer for what we'd call stage magic and illusions, a manual of trickery and deception. Its application can be seen in two stories about Sabah's preparation of the assassins. The first was recounted centuries later by Marco Polo, who was just repeating something he'd heard. But much the same tale crops up in Arab and Chinese sources. Instead of merely promising pie in the sky to his followers, Sabah let them see it and eat it, a little taste anyway. He built paradise on earth. He carefully prepared a concealed garden stocked with beautiful and exotic plants and animals, streams literally flowing with wine, milk, and honey, and stocked with the expected bevy of virgins ready to frolic. The chosen acolyte was first drugged and then awakened in the phony heaven. After a few days of delight, he was again knocked out and returned to the real world. Sabah assured him that when he died for the order, these wonders would be his again forever. This tale mentions the assassin's use of intoxicating drugs. While their supposed drug of choice was hashish, that was improbable for two reasons. First, hashish really didn't exist at the time. Second, as a concentrated form of marijuana, hashish excels at inducing the munchies, but not homicidal frenzy. On the other hand, the assassins almost certainly made use of opium and possibly psychedelic mushrooms. In another tale, Sabah swore a follower to confidence, then buried him in sand up to his chin. Blood and gore were spread around to make it look like a severed head. Other followers were then shown the head, which spoke to them, regaling them with visions of the paradise in which his soul now resided. His main job completed, the confidant was beheaded for real, and the severed head hung up for all to see. Such tales were later cited to show the diabolical dishonesty of Sabah. As tricks, however, both were doable and probably very effective. Another story attesting to Hassan Isabah's cunning relates to his acquisition of the eagle's nest in 1090. He used stealth and deception, not force. First, he sent agents to infiltrate the local population and win their favor. Other operatives penetrated the retinue of Alamut's Seljuk governor. Those agents persuaded the governor to accept a seemingly silly offer from Sabah. He offered to pay 3,000 gold pieces for an area of land that could be encompassed by a single cowhide. Sabah then had the hide carefully cut into a single long cord, a cord long enough to surround the whole eagle's nest. The story is probably apocryphal. The same trick has been attributed to many others, but it shows how Hassan Isabah became legendary. Yet another tale is that after establishing himself in Alamut, he left his rooms only twice over the next 35 years. He ceased to be a man and became a presence, a figure of dread and mystery, the old man of the mountain. By the time of Sabah's death, at about age 90 in 1124, his invisible empire was in full swing. The assassins didn't consist of just the old man and a gaggle of killers. Alamut was only the most important of a string of 18 fortresses scattered across Persia. In 1141, the assassins captured Masyaf Castle in northwestern Syria, extending their power almost to the Mediterranean. This Syrian bastion, which would outlast Alamut, also brought the assassins into direct contact with the Knights Templar, the storied and controversial order of Christian crusaders. The bedrock of the assassin order, as with the Templars, were the lay helpers, or Lasiks, which numbered thousands of ordinary soldiers, masons, carpenters, and peasants. The lowest level of initiates was the Fidai, or Fidavis, the faithful. These provided the recruits for assassin training. Above the Fidai were the Rafiks, the companions, who functioned as an administrative and officer class. Higher still were the Dais, the missionaries. They were roughly the equivalent of the Templar Knights. At the very top was the Dai al-Kabir, the Grand Missionary or Grand Master. All initiates wore the same basic uniform, a white tunic and a red sash, signifying purity and blood. Exactly the same colors featured in Templar attire. In the 135 years following Sabah's death, Alamut saw seven more Grand Masters, all Sabah's descendants. The fourth Grand Master, Hassan the Hated, dared to proclaim himself an incarnation of the Hidden Imam, the ultimate religious authority of the Shia. His successor, Muhammad II, openly repudiated Islam. But the next master, Jalal ud-Din, reaffirmed Islamic allegiance and even made a pilgrimage to Mecca. Doubtless everything was for show. The assassin chiefs kept their fingers on the pulse of politics, adjusting their stance as the situation dictated. Assassinations were a means of influencing a situation, but not the only one. Sabah and his successors waged psychological warfare on multiple fronts. Their invisible empire was a vast intelligence and propaganda network. They collected information and leaked or sold it to whomever seemed appropriate, or who paid the most. As time went on, the authority of Alamut's masters weakened, and the Syrian branch acted independently. The Syrians' greatest leader was Rashid al-Din Sinan, who ruled Masyaf from 1162 to 1193. He was the assassin leader the Crusaders called the Old Man of the Mountain. In 1192, his fidais murdered the newly named Crusader King of Jerusalem, Conrad of Montferrat. The killers struck him down at prayer. Taken prisoner and subjected to torture, they died laughing about the joys awaiting them in paradise. Some suspect the real agent of Conrad's demise was his English rival, King Richard the Lionheart, who supposedly paid the assassins for the hit. Or was it a favor that Richard was expected to return? The assassins were probably credited with more murders than they actually committed. But that also worked to their advantage. What was true didn't matter, only what people believed or simply suspected to be true. The Syrian assassins maintained a long and complicated relationship with the Christian Crusaders, above all with the Knights Templar. In 1172, Sinan made an offer to Amalric, another Crusader king of Jerusalem, and the Templars' theoretical overlord. He and his whole order would convert to Christianity if the assassins' annual tribute payments to the Templars were dropped. King Amalric agreed, but the Templars scotched the deal and murdered Sinan's emissary. Did they know the offer of conversion was just another ruse? After all, to the assassins, all religions were equally bogus. The assassin-crusader connection didn't end there. In 1214, the French clergyman Jacques de Vitry became bishop of the crusader stronghold of Acre. He wrote a history of his experiences, including interesting details about the assassins. He recounts that the Syrian Old Man of the Mountain commanded 40,000 fighters and held 10 great castles, all considered impregnable. The assassins revered their master as a virtual god and would do anything he commanded. The bishop viewed the assassins as a religion unto themselves, with only a nominal connection to Islam. In 1250, King Louis IX of France arrived in Acre to lead a seventh crusade. Assassin representatives convinced him not to use his army to recover Jerusalem, but to attack their Sunni Mamluk enemies in Egypt. That crusade ended in disaster and Louis' death. To the assassins, the crusaders were never allies, but just more pawns in the game. The assassins' real foe was always the Sunni Abbasid Caliphate and all who served it. Sinan's nemesis just happened to be the same as that of the crusaders, the Sunni Kurdish general Saladin. Sinan reportedly twice tried to have Saladin killed, but the fidais missed their mark both times. Still, that didn't prevent Saladin and Sinan from making a temporary alliance a few years later. Coincidence or not, the Abbasid Caliphate experienced a string of disasters soon after the appearance of the assassins. The first was the collapse of the Seljuk Sultanate, precipitated by the assassination of Malik Shah. This opened the floodgates for the invasion of fresh, unruly, and destructive Turkish tribes, which in turn provoked the onslaught of the Crusaders, who seized Jerusalem in 1099. The Abbasid disasters finally culminated in the Mongols' apocalyptic sack of Baghdad in 1258. Great Baghdad, the Rome of Islam, was utterly destroyed, its population slaughtered, and the Abbasid caliph trampled to death. But the advent of the Mongols also spelled the demise of the assassins. The second to the last assassin leader, Alauddin Aladdin, reportedly dispatched hundreds of fedais in a futile effort to kill the Mongol Khan, Mungke. In rage, the Khan decided to exterminate the sect. One by one, the assassin castles fell, and finally Alamut in 1256. The last successor of Hasan I Sabah, Rukin ud-Din, was hauled off to Mongolia, where he died under uncertain circumstances. The Syrian assassins held out a while longer. Freed of control from Persia, the masters of Masyaf conducted business as they saw fit. In 1260, they, along with some crusaders, first abetted the Mongol invasion of Syria and Palestine, and then turned on them to make common cause with the Mongols' enemies, the Mamluk rulers of Egypt. The Mamluks, Sunni Muslims, were not grateful. In 1270, they took Masyaf without a fight. Still, the assassins didn't just vanish. The survivors were ordered by someone, no one knows who, to conceal their faith and await a signal that the cult was in full operation again. Are they still waiting?